You're listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. I'm your host this week, Bill Lynch. On this West Virginia Week, a new obesity report paints a grim picture for West Virginians, but can anything be done? Also, Americans have been struggling with housing for years, but is the market changing? And a new novel set in Pocahontas County tells the story of two high school students as they unravel a decades-old mystery. Let's jump right in with a few short news stories. There is a growing concern that the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which provides food benefits for low-income families, won't be available next month. Maria Young reports.
About one in six people, roughly 277,000 West Virginians, including 100,000 children, rely on SNAP benefits for food. In previous shutdowns, administrations from both parties have used contingency funds to provide those benefits, and that is a possibility this time. Kelly Allen with the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy says, if not, local charities do not have the resources to meet that $50 million monthly level of need.
For every meal that a food pantry or charitable provider provides, SNAP provides 12 meals. And I just say that to put it in the scope of how difficult it would be to absorb something of this scale.
Governor Patrick Morrissey's office says, like other states, West Virginia does not have the budget to shoulder those costs. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston.
Citizen groups are continuing their opposition to a microgrid energy facility in Tucker County. Chris Schultz has more.
Tucker United, West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, and Friends of Blackwater are appealing to the state's Intermediate Court of Appeals to get more information about the proposed Ridgeline Power Plant in Tucker County. Olivia Miller of West Virginia Highlands Conservancy says information important to public safety, like emissions data and design details, are blacked out on the company's permit application.
From the start, the project has raised a lot of concerns, not just because of its potential pollution and size, but also because of how little the public has been allowed to know about it.
This filing comes on the heels of a separate legal action last month when citizen groups challenged the Department of Environmental Protection's approval of the Ridgeline Air Quality Permit, also citing excessive secrecy. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
The city of Clarksburg is getting more money to remove lead water lines in the city. Maria Young reports.
Governor Patrick Morrissey announced Monday a $19 million state contribution that he said is part of a $50 million project to replace lead service lines and ensure safe, reliable water for residents and businesses. The governor highlighted some of the ongoing challenges and health dangers that could exist if the repairs are not made, including dangerous contaminants that leak from lead pipes and into the drinking water, and pose a risk for children, pregnant women, and older adults.
Even small amounts of lead can cause long-term damage to kids, whether it's developmental or neurological damage.
Morrissey said the project will also strengthen fire protection and update water meters to help the community deliver safe drinking water. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston.
Norfolk Southern hauled more coal for domestic consumption in the third quarter than coal for export. As Curtis Tate reports, that reflects trends in where coal is going by railroad.
In the 3 months ending on September 30th, Norfolk Southern moved nearly 8.8 million tons of coal for U.S. power plants, according to a financial presentation on Thursday, a 6% increase from the year before. That's the reverse of a year ago, when the railroads moved 8.8 million tons for overseas markets. This year, the railroad's export tonnage fell 16%. Export coal has fallen this year amid foreign competition in metallurgical coal, the kind used to make steel. Norfolk Southern taps southern West Virginia's coal reserves, which are rich in met coal. It is shipped by rail to the port of Norfolk, Virginia. Rival CSX has seen a similar change in its coal shipment patterns. Norfolk Southern is preparing for a merger with the nation's biggest rail carrier, Union Pacific. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection has issued a total of 5 notices of violation to the Mountain Valley Pipeline since it opened last year. Curtis Tate has more.
The Mountain Valley Pipeline received 3 notices of violation from the DEP this year, in addition to the 2 it received last year after becoming operational in June 2024. It has received a total of 10 notices from the department since construction resumed on the nearly $10 billion project in mid-2023 following a mandate from Congress. The 303-mile, 42-inch diameter pipeline transports as much as 2 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day from north-central West Virginia to southern Virginia. This year's notices were issued in Summers, Monroe, and Webster counties. All of the notices related to erosion control or water quality. No penalties were issued. Last year, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality fined MVP for erosion and sediment control and the release of water during pressure tests. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
You're listening to West Virginia Week, and now for some of our top feature stories from the past week. America's housing crisis presents a range of challenges for buyers and renters. While inventories have improved in the past year, there are few good options for those with low or fixed income. On the latest Encore episode of Us and Them, host Trey Kay looks at the struggle as cities try to redevelop neighborhoods and residents in manufactured home parks pay double or triple for their lot lease. One of Kay's guests is Claudia Aiken, who directs the Housing Initiative, a research program at the University of Pennsylvania. Here's an excerpt.
Once again, America is staring down the barrel of its long-term housing issues, only now with added complications from the last few years. Take the rental market. Overall, price hikes slowed over 2022, but nationally, costs are still well above what they were pre-COVID. And if you're trying to buy a house, that's gotten more complicated too. In response to inflation, and the housing boom of 2021, the government raised interest rates on mortgages, making it more expensive to buy. Plus, American wages haven't kept up with inflation. Add the two together, and you get a set of hurdles many Americans simply can't afford. Aiken says a lot of this turmoil can be tied back to one problem.
We don't have enough housing. And when you've got that shortage, there's more competition for it and prices go up.
Are we seeing that demand cooling off?
I think it's fair to say there was some counter movement during the pandemic, but that's the last, 2 to 3 years. But in terms of the last decade, when I think of a city like Philadelphia, for example, that had been depopulating for years and years and years following the Industrial Revolution, which, seems like ancient history, in the last decade is when the city was kind of reborn and saw people moving in greater numbers for the very first time. And that shifted the housing market totally and in a way that the city might not have totally been prepared for.
And that is how I ended up on I-95 South, heading towards the city of brotherly love. So, I'm walking down the street here in Philadelphia with my friend and producer, Christina Stella.
Hi!
We're walking in West Philadelphia in a neighborhood called Squirrel Hill.
I lived here when I was in my early 20s, and that's a common story that you're going to hear about this neighborhood. It's right near the University of Pennsylvania. It has a long and checkered past. Outside of that, but this is kind of a place where a lot of young people come to maybe rent their first apartments, live in their first house with friends from college or while they're studying at the university. You've got Drexel University, University of the Sciences, University of Pennsylvania here.
West Philly's growth was underpinned by the invention of public transit.
That's the trolley there.
Depending on the block, you might see vast 6 to 10 room homes with turrets, Queen Anne molding, and bright paint jobs. Head a few blocks south or west, and it's mostly smaller row homes.
It has a long and rich history of, at first, being a place where wealthy, moneyed people had their big Victorians. And over the course of the 20th century, it increasingly became a place where working class people lived.
That's an excerpt from the latest Encore Us and Them episode entitled The Housing Struggle. Tune in Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. on West Virginia Public Broadcasting to hear the entire episode or find it on our website at wvpublic.org. Us and Them is supported by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. When Trust for America's Health, or TIFA, released its latest state of obesity report, the news for West Virginia was not surprising. The state once again has the highest percentage of overweight adults in the nation. What might surprise you is part of what's driving those grim health statistics has nothing to do with food. Maria Young caught up with TIFA President and CEO Dr. Nadine Gracia to find out what's behind this alarming trend and what can be done.
For, unfortunately, West Virginia, we've been at or near the top of this kind of data for quite some time now. Can you talk to me a little bit about what the figures show about West Virginia?
Yes, so specifically in West Virginia, the rate of adult obesity in 2024 is 41.4%. So that is above the national rate, and it continues to be slightly increased from the previous year. And as you noted, West Virginia has had higher rates of adult obesity over the years, and we've actually seen that it's not only in terms of obesity, but also other related chronic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure.
So, you know, it's interesting. I looked at some of the data, not just about West Virginia, but nationwide. And, you know, for example, Colorado has a pretty low obesity rate. And if you look at West Virginia and Colorado, you know, we have a lot of outdoor activities. We have a lot of mountainous terrain. We have a lot of hiking trails. We have a lot of whitewater rafting and a pretty big emphasis on people getting out and about. Even our governor has put an emphasis on this. He's trying to lose a little weight himself, and he's been emphasizing the Mountaineer Mile and putting up hiking trails and having press conferences at locations where people can go out and be active. So I feel like the state's tried to do some things. What are we not doing that Colorado is doing? And what can a state like ours do to combat these figures?
When you look at what's happening in the state of West Virginia, what we see, for example, are that there are there is a higher rate than the national average in terms of poverty in the nation, and that's both adult and child poverty. And you pointed out in particular the governor launching the Mountaineer Mile program, which is important, a great way to encourage residents of the state to engage in physical activity. When we look at actually the built environment and kind of the community conditions and structures to promote walking and biking, actually the state has a very low percentage of children who have access, for example, to sidewalks or walking paths, parks and playgrounds in their neighborhoods. And that's a way to get that kind of physical activity and active transportation that's also helpful in addressing obesity and chronic disease. And then there's also high rates of food insecurity, so meaning households that, you know, have either limited or uncertain availability of foods that are nutritionally adequate and safe foods. And so those are some opportunities.
You know, you mentioned food insecurity, and on the surface, it would seem that that kind of a term would fly in the face of an issue like obesity, because if you don't have enough food, you know, logically speaking, how can you have a weight problem? How can you be eating too much if you don't have enough to begin with? But that's not really quite how it plays out, is it?
That's right. It's not how it plays out. Actually, you know, what happens if you think about it, if you've got a family, a household where they're just struggling to make ends meet and put food on the table, that often the food that you can afford, often healthy, nutritious foods are often more expensive. And the food that is available, that is lower cost, it may have higher calories, but at the same time, they're less nutritious and actually therefore can increase the risk of being overweight or having obesity. Similarly to poverty, poverty is a strong indicator for overweight and obesity, you know, for some similar reasons that if you have lower income, don't have access to healthy, affordable foods, are in more under-resourced settings, that what may be available to you, while it may have be high in calories, it likely is less nutritious, and so therefore also increases the risk of obesity and other chronic diseases.
That was TIFA President and CEO Dr. Nadine Gracia talking with Maria Young about what is driving West Virginia's obesity rates. A new young adult novel set in Pocahontas County tells the story of a friendship between two high school students as they unravel a decades-old mystery. It's the debut novel by Jessica Walker. Inside Appalachia's Mason Adams spoke with Walker about the secret astronomers and her connection to Appalachia.
What led you to set this story in West Virginia, and specifically Pocahontas County near the Green Bank Telescope?
I remember driving through West Virginia as a kid and seeing the Green Bank Telescope for the first time, and you feel like you're on another planet. You're in the middle of rural Appalachia. You're surrounded by dairy barns and a Dollar General and hay fields, and all of a sudden this amazing piece of technology rises out of the earth. I've always just been fascinated with that area. And many years later, after I grew up and I went to college, I took a bunch of astronomy classes. I don't quite have the brain for astrophysics. I'm more of an artist, but I took as many astronomy classes as I could. And we learned about the Green Bank Observatory and the National Radio Quiet Zone and how it's an epicenter for the search for extraterrestrial life. And I just am fascinated by that. And the telescope itself, it's massive. It's the size of a football stadium in the air. And standing next to it is completely humbling. And it can point in any direction. I've learned a lot about it. I got to visit as part of the research for the book. And scientists from all over the world are coming to Green Bank to use this amazing piece of technology to search for patterns in radio waves that might indicate life beyond our Earth.
I'm interested in hearing your perspective on the mountains. As someone who grew up in the region and then moved to New York about 20 years ago, I know for a lot of folks, they have a complicated relationship with their home community, but sometimes moving away provides some clarity. Can you talk a little bit more about your connection to Appalachia and sort of how the move to New York shifted it or changed it?
My people are from McDowell County, West Virginia. My grandmother was from Welch, and my grandfather grew up in Gary, West Virginia, what they call Number 10 Mine back in the U.S. Steel days. So I definitely have family roots in that part of the world. On the other side of my family's from Wise County, Virginia, and I grew up down the road in Washington County, Virginia. And I lived there until I was the ripe old age of 18. And then I decided I had to get out of there and run away to California, actually, and live in San Francisco, because I just thought that would be the coolest thing to do. And it was. And I don't regret it, but I learned a lot of things in the move away from Southwestern Virginia. Being a kid that grew up in Southwestern Virginia means you have this really playful connection to the land, I think. You get into a lot of good country trouble. You are really immersed in nature. And this is a very different experience than the way I'm raising my children in Brooklyn, which, for better or for worse, I think we all have our childhoods and learn interesting things. But I moved away a long time ago, but this place of Appalachia is in my blood, and it continues to humor me and haunt me in ways that just seem to come out as stories. So I really hope that readers experience a new perspective on rural Appalachia. And in particular, in the book, through Kepler's perspective, she's the one that's born and bred in Pocahontas County. We do see some of the challenges that young Appalachian folks are more likely to face: lack of resources or opportunities for higher education or incarcerated family members. But Kepler's character really grapples with the stereotypes, and she brings depth and nuance to her situation. And she also recognizes the ways that she has to change and adapt her thinking. I hope readers will find that relatable, and maybe they'll learn something too.
The Secret Astronomers will be available early November. To hear the rest of that story and more, listen to Inside Appalachia, Sunday mornings at 7 and Sunday evenings at 6 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. That's it for West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week. As always, you can see these stories and more at wvpublic.org. I'm Bill Lynch.